la parola al professor Hoppe per le sue riflessioni conclusive.
This would of course take a few hours to answer all of the things that have been said here. Let me begin by saying at least a few remarks about what a natural order as the alternative to a democracy is. In a natural order, the security of life and property and the individual striving for personal happiness, security in one word, will be provided by freely financed firms. They must find clients who want them to do this thing. Now imagine, for instance, there would be a firm coming your way that would say something like this. It can be police, an insurer, or some arbitrator. And this person would say something like this. I don't guarantee you anything contractually. I do not tell you which things I will actually protect. I will not tell you which things I will actually recognize as your property. I will not tell you what I will do in case I didn't do what I promised you to do. And in any case, however, I have the right to determine unilaterally what the price is that you must pay for this type of service, okay? Who would want to be insured with a company like this? The answer is only complete idiots would want to be insured with something like this. Now, this is precisely the situation that you have with states, whether democratic or undemocratic. You do not have a contract. There's no individual contract with what the state does and that you signed. They do not tell you what it is that they protect. They tell you what the price is that you need to pay for something that they do not explain to you what it is that they will do. Then in addition, they say, and I, by means of legislation, I can change the rules of the game as it goes along. Something that was legal yesterday will be illegal tomorrow and vice versa. This is what states do. Do you want to be protected by this type of entity, or do you want to be protected by a company that signs a contract with you? A private company that protects your life and so forth must offer following thing. A contract, the contract must stipulate, in order to be acceptable by any client, a clear description of what it is that is yours, that is recognized as this is your property, this is what I will protect. They must clearly stipulate this is the price that you will have to pay, and these are the counter offer, these are my achievements that I will offer in return. If you are not satisfied with that, you can change the company and hire a different company. The rules of the contract can only be changed if both parties mutually agree to such a thing. Okay. I think this by itself, this simple elaboration of what a private company would have to do to protect you and what states actually do shows that it is simply absurd to think that the state will ever be a good protector of life and property. The state, by definition, is, so to speak, an expropriating property protector. It is a contradiction in terms. When it comes to constitutions, let me only say this. The constitutions are state constitutions. Who interprets these constitutions? Employees of the state. If I go to the state, I never signed an agreement that you can tax me on such and such, or that you expropriate such and such from me, or that you just raise the price, that is, raise the taxes. If you go to the court, Supreme Court in the United States or Germany or Italy, and say, I never signed this sort of thing, do you think you will be getting a hearing at the court? They will laugh you out of the court. They protect the interest of the state. They do not protect the interest of private property owners, nor the lives of individuals. Now to a few additional considerations that take account of some of the things that that have been said here. As I said, there is, of course, an alternative to democracy. I indicated that at least briefly. If you are interested in that, on my website, you find an article in English, The Idea of a Private Law Society, where all of these things are explained. And there exists a much elaborated new version that was written in German, which is also on my website, State or Private Law, Private Law Society. So if you want to know details about how the arbitration procedures would go on and so forth, please consult these articles. As far as majority rule or the definition of democracy is concerned, Mises at some point defines as democracy as self-determination. But that is a very unusual definition, and what Mises has in mind is with self-determination, every person has the right to secede from a given state. Now, if every person does have the right to secede to the level of individuals, then, of course, I'm also a democrat. But if you are not allowed to secede, if you are forced into some compound, then, and in this compound, majority rule is accepted, then I'm opposed to it. And you should be opposed to it too, because in no other area in your life would you accept democratic majority rule. Would you accept majority rule to determine who should build computers? Would you accept majority rule who should just make your suits or your shoes? You would say, no, every person determines who he thinks is the best shoemaker, the best dressmaker, the best computer producer, and so forth. But why would we accept the idea when it comes to determine who should judge who is right and wrong in cases of conflict? That is an enormously important function in social life. Why would we say there to determine who the appropriate judge is? That is determined by majority vote. In all other areas, far less important than judging who is right and wrong in cases of conflict, we would say you must be nuts to suggest that majority should determine this. In this particular case, we are supposed to believe that the majority determines who the best judge is in cases of conflict. Again, that seems to me just almost mind-bogglingly wrong. An old friend of mine died a few years ago, an old Austrian gentleman, Erich Ritter von Kühnelt-Ledin, wrote also very critical things on democracy. He always told me, Hans, you always have to mention that the two most important people in Western civilization, or on the one hand, Socrates, and on the other hand, Jesus, both of them were killed by democracy. We have no democracy in the family. Imagine what it would be if we take votes in the family, the children determine what happens with the property of the parents. It strikes me as absurd. We have no democracy in the church. There are clear-cut hierarchies in the church. That is, in the two most important institutions of human civilization, namely the family and the church, democracy plays absolutely no role. And whenever it did play a role, like during in the Protestant churches where there were democratic elements, it usually turned out to be a big disaster. Somebody made the point that But we have to make distinctions between different types of government. Yes, we have to make distinctions between different types of government. All governments are, so to speak, gangster organizations, but not all gangsters are equal. I have a friend who went to an ATM machine to get money out of the machine, get this 500 euros, and some guy stood behind him with a knife, said, "Give me your 500 euros. He handed over his 500 euros, then he started negotiating with the robber and said, "You know, it's late at night, I wanted to have a few beers, and now I can't have a few beers." So this robber gave him 20 euros back of the money that he just stole from him. It can also happen to you that you start negotiating with robbers, and instead of just giving you a little bit back, they also kick your teeth out and break your bones. Now, this is the difference between, let's say, the United States government and the former Soviet Union government. Yes, there exists difference, but nonetheless, gangsters they are all. Just some gangsters you prefer over other gangsters, because some people do worse things to you than other people do. Progress. Yeah, of course progress has happened, but progress has not happened because of states or because of democracy. It has happened in spite of it. Now, last thing I want to talk about is the topic that was assigned to this afternoon discussion. This is Progresso de Integrazione Europea. All states must begin small. They are territorially small things. But all states have a tendency towards centralization. There's a simple reason for this. In every person, there is a mixture of aggressive and non-aggressive impulses. One reason that you don't give in to your aggressive impulses is typically that you have to pay the cost of that is involved becoming aggressive. I have to buy my own weapons, I have to hire my own bodyguards, and whatever it is. States, however, are by nature more aggressive because they can externalize the cost of being aggressive onto other people. Imagine, would Bush have gone to Iraq if he and his Cheney buddies and so forth had to pay this whole endeavor out of their own pocket? The answer is, of course, they would not have gone to it. They would have loved to do this damage that they have done. But they would have felt, hey, that is too expensive, I can't do it. Because of that, I don't do it. If, however, I can just load all the cost onto other people, then it is easy for people to go to war, engage in aggressive activities. Now, trying to explain further how the process of centralization takes place. So states by nature tend to be warlike institutions. Who wins in wars and who loses in wars? Obviously, if you conduct wars, you have to have a productive population. The population, after all, must produce the weapons. They have to be continuing to produce somehow to just pay the taxes that are needed in order to conduct the war. Now, which state will tend to have larger amounts of resources? And the answer, more liberal states. That is, states that treat, like the nice gangster, that treat their population nicer. They have more productive populations. So we reach some sort of paradoxical conclusion. The conclusion is those states that are internally nice, that treat their own population better than others, tend to be more aggressive in their foreign policy because they know that we will likely win. If you compare the foreign policy of the Soviet Union and the United States, for instance, you can see, yes, of course, the United States is a much nicer gangster state than the Soviet Union was. It is because of that that the United States is far richer than the population in the Soviet Union were. But in terms of foreign policy, of course, the United States engaged in far more foreign interventions than the Soviet Union did. not because the Soviet Union guys were good guys. No, they were catastrophe, disaster. But nonetheless, they full well knew that it was almost impossible because of their inefficient economy that they would come out successful against a country like the United States that has similar size, similar population numbers, and so forth. Because of that, they stayed out. On the other hand, the United States, because they knew we will win in all of these endeavors, they, of course, engaged in ever more aggressive foreign policies. So we do have a tendency for states to concentrate, to ultimately reach the point where you have some sort of world empire. We have not reached that yet, but there is a tendency in that direction. Now, what's wrong about this process is the following. Europe, I think Carlo Lottieri mentioned that before, Europe was a continent that was highly decentralized as compared, let's say, with China. And the fact that Europe was highly decentralized had what Jean Bechler referred to as political anarchy, lots of independent entities. That was one of the main reasons why Europe became the dominant region, economically speaking, in the world. Why? Because from small regions, people can vote with their feet against it. If somebody oppresses them, they will simply locate their business someplace else. And that puts a brake on the attempt of every government to try to strangle people economically, enrich themselves at the expense of their population and so forth. Not that they wouldn't like to do it, they can't because people simply run away from them. In addition, if you are a very small state, if you are very, like Liechtenstein or so, you could not possibly engage in protectionist measures. If you engage in protectionist measures, that is, you shield yourself from foreign imports, your population will be dead in a week. That is, small states must engage in free trade policies. Now imagine you have a world state. There is no competition anymore. People cannot move with their feet because wherever you move, the same tax and regulation structure applies. Now this is precisely what the purpose of the European Union is. They did not want to just create a free trade zone. Every day I watch German TV and I see proudly they report that they again found some smugglers smuggling cigarettes from Poland where they are taxed less to Germany. I thought free trade means whenever you ship something out, you can ship it out. Whenever you want to ship something to your place, you can do it. The European Union has nothing to do with it. There are hundreds of thousands of pages that declare what the European Union is. Now, free trade needs two sentences. Whatever you want to ship out, whatever you want to receive from another place, imported it. Not thousands of pages. The North American Trade Agreement, exactly the same. They have not reached the 100,000 page numbers yet, but it is in the 20,000s or something like this. But the same nonsense idea. What they want to do is they want to harmonize the tax and regulation structures in all of these countries in order to make it possible that these states can cooperate more peacefully, so to speak, rip off their population more and more. Look what they did, what the OECD did when they complained, for instance, about Liechtenstein. They are unfair competitors. Why are they unfair competitors? Because they only charge about 5%, they take out 5% of GDP in terms of taxes, and the other countries take 50. That is, of course, very unfair on the part of Liechtenstein as compared to these other countries that they behave in such a way. So they want to oppress places like Liechtenstein so that they also have 50% taxes taken out of the paychecks of individuals. So the centralization that we see in Europe is an enormously dangerous thing. Secession is the answer. What we need is we need 500 Liechtensteins in Europe instead of one Brussels monster that exists and tells people in Calabria and in Poland and wherever it is what they have to do. Let me just complete this by saying the same thing, of course, also applies to monetary affairs. There we have this wonderful euro. Now, the euro was also introduced in order to reduce competition between different currencies. The situation that existed before the introduction of the euro was Germany had traditionally the strongest currency in Europe, not because of any virtues of the Germans. The reason for that was that the Germans were particularly sensitive when it came to inflation because they were twice wiped out in the course of one generation by hyperinflation. So there was, in the public opinion, there was a certain amount of weariness about what can happen if governments print too much paper money. That's the reason. There was no, again, no particular virtue on the German part. But all other currencies continuously devaluated, had to continuously devaluate against the German mark. The lira constantly fell against the German mark. The French franc constantly fell. The Greek drachma constantly fell. The Spanish peseta constantly fell against against the German mark. This leads people to just drop their currencies, get out of liras, get out of pesetas, get out of drachmas, whatever it is, and go into German marks. No government likes to see this. On the other hand, Germany was, so to speak, politically, militarily, the weakest country in Europe, because after all, Germans are all Nazis, all responsible for every evil thing that ever happened in recent history. Germany was occupied by American troops, so they had to be somehow brought under control, and in order to do this, they created this euro. But the euro will, of course, be more inflationary than the least inflationary European currency that existed before, namely the German mark. It was precisely the fact that the German mark always appreciated other currencies, depreciated, that didn't allow Greece to inflate as much as they wanted. It didn't allow Italy to inflate as much as they wanted because the consequence was always, then your currency will fall against the German mark. So how can we prevent this? Oh, we create a European Central Bank and they will then more easily inflate because that gremium is occupied by one German, one Spanish, one Greek guy, and so forth, and there's democratic decisions are made how much money, how many euros they should print. Now you still have the same problem. You still have several currencies. You have the dollar and we have the euro. They both would love to inflate more, but if you inflate more than the other guy does, again, your currency will fall against the other. What is the ultimate solution to this? The ultimate solution is we would have to have a world central bank issuing a world paper money, and then we can inflate as much as we want because that currency, by definition, cannot fall against other currencies. And this is what they are working on currently. That is, the current financial crisis has, of course, led to more cooperation between all the various central banks. And the best thing would be, of course, dominated by the United States. Unfortunately, that doesn't work anymore because now the Chinese don't seem to be cooperating. Maybe America has to declare war against them, too, after they're finished with Iran. And then we get a world currency, and the world currency will give you inflation like you have never seen in your life before. So this entire project of the European integration and monetary integration is a sheer disaster, and is also something that has much to do with our beloved democracy. With this, I know I did not answer many other important questions, but that should be sufficient. Thank you very much.